From NPR News, you're listening to our podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, the worst drought in half a century, is changing lives across America.
But we have never been in such an extended drought or as extreme as it is in these last 3 years.
This week, the world lost the proverbial mother of the gay rights movement. We remember PFLAG founder Jean Manford. And then it came from under the sea, our first view of a giant squid.
It just was like it was kind of doing a fan dance and just showing us little bits of itself.
And when a fatal hospital infection killed David Goldhill's father, he went on a quest.
All of us are bearing this extraordinary cost. We just don't see it because it's so many different hands into our pocket.
And in another new book, we learn about a relatively unknown but influential mathematician named Dorothy Rinch.
But she had a beautiful vision that had excited many, many people.
And for music, the girls' singer, Christopher Owens, going solo with Lisandra, a new album.
Just when I thought it was over, I said, come sit on my lap.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
I hadn't tried to kiss you yet.
Feeling the heat, 2012 was the hottest year ever on record in the U.S., and together with the lack of rain, it's brought on an historic drought.
The worst drought since 1956.
Every plant, corn plant out here has these dead, dry leaves attached to it.
Likely mean higher food prices.
The drought disaster of 2012 has far-reaching effects.
Drought is devastating. Think hundreds of forest fires. Drought is costly. Think low crop yields. It will break your water main or your home foundation. It will ruin your holiday. Drive up your grocery bill. Just ask a climatologist.
This drought could end up dwarfing the drought of record economically, which was the drought of like 1988, 1989, and it's not over. So to put it into context, I can't even do that yet. But we're hearing early estimates of anywhere from $50 to $80 billion.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has declared a disaster area in over 1,000 counties now. So whether you're a dry land farmer in Texas...
We have never been in such an extended drought or as extreme as it is in these last 3 years.
Or an Illinois senator like Dick Durbin talking about how low the water is on the Mississippi.
This is critically important to the economy of the Midwest and of the nation. Literally billions of dollars worth of goods travel that Mississippi River.
This drought is coming to your front door. Our cover story today, the ripple effects of drought. Even if it doesn't look dry outside, even if you're in a wet spot right now, an historic drought is seeing us into this new year. Let's start with the low water on the Mississippi. It hasn't been this low since 1989. Marty Heddle is a manager for AEP River Operations. That's a St. Louis-based barge company, and its hundreds of barges and towboats are traveling in shorter convoys that sit higher in the water.
With the drought scenario we're in on the Mississippi, the low water conditions is just about brought the river to a close.
To open the Mississippi and its billions of dollars of freight, the Army Corps of Engineers turns to dredging to deepen the river bottom, putting places like Thebes, Illinois, on the map.
Well, in these type of conditions, we're limited to a 15-barge tow, so we're actually operating at less than 45% of our capacity right now.
The Corps of Engineers has been working hard to deepen the shipping channel. What's happening?
That's the great story we got last week. Originally, the Corps wasn't going to be able to be on site down at Thebes, Illinois, to remove the rock pinnacles before February 4th.
What are the rock pinnacles at Thebes, and what do they have to do with this story?
Well, normally the river is a sandy-type bottom. However, you get down to the actual rock bottom of the river at Thebes, and a pinnacle is like a boulder of rock on the bottom of the river, rather than sand or mud that the Corps can dredge, so hence they have to manually remove it.
I see. So is that what they did?
That's what they have been doing since about, I believe, December 16th they got in there. So that, in effect, gives us 2 more feet of depth in the river by removing these rock pinnacles that stick out above the bottom of the river.
So how do you think things look moving ahead? Are you optimistic?
I am a lot more optimistic from the word we received from the Corps last week. Long-term predictions for Thebes looks like we'll have enough water to operate at least through February 7th or 8th right now. And I'm really thinking it's going to be beyond that, at least through the 15th of February. What happens from that point forward is up to Mother Nature on how much rain she can give us.
That's Marty Hettle. He's manager of bulk sales for AEP River Operations, a St. Louis-based barge company. Mr. Hettle, thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Everything works together. One of the biggest commodities shipped on the Mississippi is grain. But in some parts of the country, like the Texas Panhandle, there's a lot less grain to ship. The Texas Panhandle is still in the grip of the drought. For the third year now, ranchers and farmers in Amarillo have been searching for signs of moisture. Last year was the second record low, 12 inches of rain, up a little from the year before, but not enough.
If this drought continues on, we're going to be forced to sell our cows this next spring.
That's Philip Smith. He's already sold off a lot of his herd. This year might be the last for the Sunshine Ranch. That's what he and his wife, Doris Smith, call their family place.
We've had a decent livelihood, yes, ma'am, until the drought has hit us about 3 years ago.
I understand that you've been in this house since 1964. Tell me, if you would, Phil, what changed 3 years ago? The drought came. How did things change?
Well, Doris has been in this house all her life. We married and moved into her folks' property. The drought, as it came on, well, we were fortunate enough to have some sub-moisture and were able to produce a less than average crop for 2 years, but this year we're probably not going to produce anything, and that is our livelihood.
Are you entirely dependent on rainfall? And if you are, what kind of crops are you growing?
We grow hard red winter wheat, grain sorghum or milo, and then a hay forage crop for our cattle.
Doris, what do your fields look like now?
There is nothing growing on them. It's pretty much bare ground, which is the reason why we're having to feed up the hay bales, which Philip had purchased in the summertime, because Philip is feeding every single thing that the cattle eat. So there is nothing left for the cattle to graze on. And then even the crops that we did plant in the late summer and early fall, because of the lack of moisture, those crops have died.
I am so sorry to hear that.
Jackie, I want you to understand that we're not just an individual farming unit that is out here that is suffering from the drought. I mean, this is very widespread. And when you consider that if you eat, you are involved in agriculture, this is really affecting the whole nation. It affects everybody. When agriculture is down and agriculture is being depressed, the entire world is affected by that.
That's Doris and Philip Smith. We reached them at their ranch, the Sunshine Ranch in Amarillo, and we really want to wish you very good luck and thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Yes. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
You can call and visit us anytime you want to.
Climatologists are hesitant to link any one drought to climate change, but there is consensus that there will be more severe dry spells in the years to come. Mark Svoboda is a climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. And about a decade ago, he helped create an international drought tracking system. You can click on the map and see how your county is doing.
When we first started the idea conceptually, people didn't realize that drought, on average, is the number one cause of economic loss in the country, or at least on par and rivaling hurricanes. And when you went around the country and talked to folks, they just weren't aware of that fact. So the main goal was to heighten visibility of drought as a natural hazard that affects millions of people covering millions of square miles across our country.
So this past summer, as we know, droughts across the Midwest and the Southwest were as bad as they've been in 50 years. How bad was the drought overall in the U.S. last year?
We saw over 60% of the country, nearly two-thirds at its peak there in August, September, depending on where you were. The thing that differentiates this year's drought from, say, the 1950s or the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s, right now anyway, is the duration component. The large part of this affected area really is just going into year two now. When you do look at the southern plains or the southeastern United States, where they are having issues again, like around Atlanta with Lake Lanier, Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, you do see that being a year three drought.
Mark, you talk about hoping that the two-year cycle has completed itself with 2012's passing, but what do you see when you look ahead?
You know, everywhere, say, east of the Rockies, this is the dry time of year. So you're not going to expect to see major recovery, at least during the winter months. Unfortunately, it wasn't an overly wet fall. So I think we're going to be locked into this drought until spring. When you get that rain, it isn't just 1 inch. If that's normal per week, that sounds great. What we really need is 2 inches per week.
Mark, you're out in the center of the country, but we know that people are affected besides just, say, agricultural people. Who does drought impact?
Well, that's the thing about drought. It is very cross-cutting across many economic sectors, which makes it one of the most costliest hazards that we see out there. Obviously, people see it sort of in the grocery store when they talk about food prices, but there's a lot of other things we're seeing happen. Things like physical and mental health are a big thing. You know, we saw a lot more complaints of allergies and respiratory illness, given the kicking up of dust and the winds with the heat waves. That's been a big thing. You see increased suicides with people that are literally losing their livelihoods if they've had a farm or ranch through multiple generations that's been lost. It's a tragic thing. Droughts are very local in their impacts. And, you know, we've seen a lot of issues with water main breaks across the U.S., especially in the midsection from Minnesota, Wisconsin, all the way down to Texas. For example, in Houston, normally they might see 200 breaks a day. They were seeing 700 a day during the summer months due to the dryness of the soil, as well as the aging infrastructure. It's not just the drought, but a lot of these things are wreaking havoc on our infrastructure.
Mark Svoboda, drought projections are getting more severe. Is there any kind of preparation? Many cities are accustomed to preparing to some degree for tornadoes. You can build a shelter for hurricanes. You absolutely vacate, things like that. What about drought? Is there any way to prepare for it?
Yeah, I don't like the word drought-proofing because you can't stop droughts from occurring. What you can do is reduce your risk to those droughts. And, you know, even the ability to catch rain off your roof and use it for a garden, to reuse it for those types of purposes, a lot of places that's not allowed. So we have to think out of the box a little bit and become a little bit more flexible on how to maximize and capture as much of that water as we can to reuse locally. Those types of steps are things I think that we can do. The basic infrastructure ones are the easy ones. It's the more conservation mentality that even when times are good, you know, let's preserve that water, get it back in the ground so that we can tap into it when things go dry like they are now.
That's Mark Svoboda. He's a climatologist with the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he joined us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jackie.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Earlier this week, we lost an important figure in the gay rights movement. Jean Manford was a shy, petite lady, only 5'2", from Flushing, Queens. A mother and an elementary school teacher, she became an activist for gay rights, drawn in by her son's involvement in the 1970s. She realized children like her son couldn't do it alone. They needed their families to be involved, too. She founded PFLAG, the national support group better known as Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. NPR's Lily Percy brings us this remembrance.
In 2009, President Obama made a speech at his annual human rights campaign dinner.
Soon after the protests at Stonewall, 40 years ago, the phone rang in the home of a soft-spoken elementary school teacher named Jean Manford.
In his speech, the president told the story of Jean Manford, whose son Morty was an out gay man and an important figure in New York's gay community during the turbulent 1970s. The phone call Manford received was from a police officer who told her that Morty had been arrested for protesting at Stonewall.
And then the officer added one more thing. And you know, he's homosexual. Well, that police officer sure was surprised when Jean responded, "Yes, I know. Why are you bothering him?"
Jean Manford always supported her son, Morty.
When my brother needed her, she just dropped everything for him. She was like a mother bear.
That's Manford's daughter, Suzanne. Suzanne was 21 when Morty came out. A few years earlier, Manford's oldest son, Charles, had died from an accidental drug overdose. So when Morty ended up in the hospital in 1972, after being brutally beaten at a protest rally, Jean Manford knew that she had to act.
My mother was beside herself with rage that anybody could hurt her child. She had already lost one, and the fact that she could have lost another, she was seething.
After the attack, Manford wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Post, criticizing the police for not protecting him. She said, "I have a homosexual son, and I love him." 2 months later, she marched alongside Morty in what would eventually become New York's Pride March, an unprecedented move, according to writer Eric Marcus. He wrote an oral history of the gay rights movement in the U.S. called Making History.
It's a little hard to imagine now what that period was like, how revolutionary it was for a parent to walk in the Gay Pride March in New York City carrying a sign that said, "Parents unite in support of our gay children." The timing was right. The time really called for someone like Jean, and Jean was there.
In 1973, Manford organized the first formal meeting of PFLAG, which took place at a local church in Greenwich Village. 20 people gathered, and soon after, she began to receive calls from other parents all across the country who wanted to start groups in their own communities. They now have more than 350 groups nationwide. One member says that as a parent, the support group just makes sense.
She thought it was just a normal thing to do as a mother, and that's true of most all the parents who get involved.
That's former NFL commissioner Paul Tagliabue, whose son Drew is gay. He and his wife joined PFLAG, seeking support and guidance from other parents in similar situations.
They don't think they're going out there to become politicians or advocates in a unique way. They're doing what parents should do, which is care for their kids and keep their family together. And it's pretty simple when you think about it at its core.
One of the things my mom talked about being so valuable for her was, in a way, to go to a PFLAG meeting and see her pain affirmed, see her pain reflected.
Writer Dan Savage's mother was also a PFLAG member. Savage says that his mother found solace in the group because it helped her understand what it means to be gay and to be the parent of a gay child.
What Jean Manford did was she put it in people's heads that gay and lesbian people had parents, that we were somebody's children. And that was the first real big step in the movement toward full acceptance of lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people.
New York City Council member Daniel Drum is another child of a PFLAG mom. Drum was friends with Morty Manford, and when Morty passed away in 1992 of complications from AIDS, he reached out to Jean Manford, who he had never met. The two became fast friends from the first time that he ever set foot in her house.
The day I first went there, the house reeked of history. I walked in and Jean had pictures of Morty on the mantelpiece. And she took them down and she showed me them. As a matter of fact, there's a famous photo of Jean marching in that first Pride parade. And she was so proud of having that photo that moment was recorded in history.
Manford received letters from gay people all over the world, thanking her for standing up for them and for loving them unconditionally. It is this love, Drum says, that he will remember most.
Jean Manford is like the Rosa Parks of the gay rights movement. She is the mother to all gay people, but she's particularly the mother to gay people whose parents have rejected them.
Jean Manford died this past Tuesday at the age of 92. She's survived by her daughter, Suzanne, and the thousands of children whose families she influenced. Lily Percy, NPR News.
For thousands of years, sailors told stories of a giant squid. In myth and cinema, it was the most terrible of sea monsters, with a terrifying moniker of Kraken.
Release the Kraken!
Clash of the Titans. But outside of mythology, the giant squid is very real, although until recently, we'd only seen them in still photographs. After decades of searching the seas, scientists have captured the first video of a live giant squid thousands of feet below the surface of the Pacific Ocean. Edie Witter is the ocean researcher who took the footage. Welcome, and Edie, congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. It's a long time coming.
These images are really fascinating, and the camera that took the pictures was your brainchild. How did you attract the squid towards the camera?
I had been wanting for a long time to explore the ocean in a different way, because I've always been concerned about how much stuff we must be scaring away with bright, noisy submersibles. Any animal with any sense is going to get away from that. So I wanted to develop a stealthy system. And besides having a stealthy camera, I wanted to not just put down bait the way normally people do to attract animals, because dead bait is just going to attract scavengers. And so I wanted to attract active predators. And so I developed an optical lure that imitates a particular type of bioluminescent display that I thought should be attractive to large predators.
So I have a really sort of silly question. How did we know the giant squid exists if nobody had seen it?
It's not a silly question at all. Actually, the reason we know giant squid exist is they happen to float when they die. But we've really only explored 5% of the ocean, and I think we've explored that in the wrong way. I think we've been scaring a lot of animals away. So what about the stuff that doesn't float when it dies?
So what does a giant squid look like? I mean, on the video, you have this just sort of gorgeous, it almost looks like a water lily folding and unfolding, only, of course, much bigger.
The footage I got, yes, was just amazing to see it come in. The first few times that we saw it on camera, it just was like it was kind of doing a fan dance and just showing us little bits of itself. We'd see the arms kind of wave by the camera. And we did see one long shot of it, but the most spectacular shot was when it came in on the attack. And you'll note that it comes up over that sphere, which is the optical lure, and attacks the camera system itself.
What color are they?
On my camera system, you can't tell the color because it's black and white. But on the imagery that was shot from the submersible, it was a high-resolution camera, and the color was utterly different than any of us expected. The one that had been brought to the surface and that there's pictures of on the web was red, and a lot of deep-sea squid are red. But this was a spectacular silver and gold. And just, it looks like it's carved out of metal. It's just absolutely breathtaking and completely unexpected.
How large do they get and how deep are they found in the ocean?
The giant squid, from the tip of the mantle to the tip of the tentacles, I think the longest one ever measured was supposedly 55 feet. The ones we were finding from the tip of the mantle to the tip of the arms were in between 10 and 12 feet. And then the tentacles are usually another two-thirds of that. So they could have been as much as 30 feet.
Wow. How did you feel when you saw this creature on the video?
Oh, the excitement was incredible. It's just amazing to be able to have a moment like that and realize you've done something that people have been trying to do for decades. And that was actually what got me into science in the first place, this opportunity to explore a frontier, but I never, never imagined that I'd get an opportunity like this.
Edie Witter is a deep sea explorer. She's the founder of the Ocean Research and Conservation Association. She captured the first video of a giant squid swimming. And that video will air on the Discovery Channel on the 27th of January. She spoke to us from member station WQCS in Fort Pierce, Florida. Edie Witter, what an exciting discovery.
It was the excitement of my life.
In 2007, David Goldhill's 82-year-old father, who was in otherwise good health, checked into the hospital with a minor case of pneumonia. Once there, he caught a series of infections and died. Shortly thereafter, Goldhill read an article that changed his life. He learned just how common it is for hospital infections to result in death, up to 100,000 such cases each year. He also learned how simple it can be to prevent them, in some cases as simple as regulating that physicians wash their hands. So Goldhill set out to learn as much as he could about our convoluted, insurance-based healthcare system, and he found that much of it is broken. His new book is called Catastrophic Care: How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. Goldhill, who is president of the Game Show Network, approaches the topic from a business perspective, and that's why, he says, the more he learned about the industry, the stranger it all seemed.
It felt strange that any industry could have a relatively simple, low-cost way of significantly improving its customer experience. And here the customer is a patient and the experience is a life or death one. And it would be hard to get the industry to adopt it. 100,000 deaths is an extraordinary number. And there are estimates of up to 200,000 people are killed by error in a given year, a variety of errors in addition to infection. And a recent study that Medicare did suggested that one out of four hospital admissions of a Medicare beneficiary involved some type of error that had a meaningful impact on that patient's health.
Why do you suppose we don't hear more about this?
there is a sense that there is something uniquely different about healthcare. You'll often hear people say that healthcare shouldn't be a business, as if 15 million people can perform this service without caring about their economic interests. We fund all of healthcare through insurance. We, as consumers, are extraordinarily passive in healthcare. We think because our insurer or Medicare will reimburse something, we probably should do it. It's one of the explanations why there's so much waste in healthcare. And then another point in which we hold healthcare very different than everything else is we almost always think more of it is better. What I find extraordinary is almost anybody who looks at the Medicare program sees an enormous amount of waste. And what's interesting is we talk about the waste in terms of money. That's not the right way to think of it. These are treatments and tests and surgeries done on people who didn't need them, shouldn't have had them. It's an assault on their bodies. And yet that kind of accountability is something that we've given healthcare a pass on because we feel it's just so different from any other human activity.
How much are we going to pay for healthcare over our lifetimes?
In my book, I looked at an actual entry-level employee in my company. She's earning about $35,000 a year. And I said, let's look at her life. Let's assume that she's the breadwinner in the family. She does well, has a nice middle-class income, and she lives till 80, and she has a couple kids. What is that young woman going to put into our healthcare system over her lifetime? Well, the number's incredibly shocking. If there's zero growth in healthcare costs, she will put in between insurance premium, taxes, Medicare premiums, out of pocket, and I should point out this is assuming she never gets really sick. She'll put in over $1 million over her life to support her and her family's healthcare. If healthcare costs grow by only what the Affordable Care Act estimates, then the number is $1.9 million. One of the foundations of our healthcare system is that everybody thinks there's somebody else out there paying for her healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of the illusions of our insurance system. Almost everybody in the system gets in healthcare a lot less than they put in over their lifetime. And what we've done is we've created this scheme where nobody knows what they pay for anything.
Because it's so nebulous.
Because it's so nebulous and because you're never the payer. There's always an intermediary actually writing the check. And nobody knows how much they're putting in.
Well, where do we think the money comes from? I mean, do we think it comes from the government? Do we think it comes from the ether? Do we think it comes from Ponce de Leon's well in Florida that pulls up the fountain of youth?
Those are probably as likely of places as anywhere else. Most of us don't understand that our employer isn't really paying for our health insurance. We are. Every economist will tell you that money, which has grown so enormously, is just coming out of our paychecks. It's a major reason that wage rates in the United States flattened in the last decade and are expected to stay flat is because your employer is paying more and more for your health care instead of paying more and more to you. Many people think that, you know, if they're seniors, that Medicare is paying for their health care. What's interesting about seniors and what almost no one understands about Medicare is in 1965, when seniors paid for almost all of their health care themselves, roughly 10 to 12% of their income was spent on health care. This year, when seniors pay almost none of their health care themselves, Medicare pays 95% of the bill, that little 5% they pay now accounts for 20% of their income. So what you have is people who think they're being protected by having these big intermediaries between them and the price of healthcare. In fact, what those intermediaries are doing is so inflating prices, so inflating demand, building so much waste and complexity into the system that all of us are bearing this extraordinary cost. We just don't see it because it's so many different hands into our pocket. But there is no other place for the money to come from.
We can't talk about this, David Goldhill, without mentioning health care reform. And you argue that 2010's Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, really isn't much of an improvement, that it's more of an extension of what's gone wrong with the system. And we should note, as you do in your article and book, that you're a Democrat.
Well, I'm a Democrat, and I share what I think the administration's goal was of creating a national cradle-to-grave safety net. The problem is I think the Affordable Care Act is fundamentally old-fashioned in what it understood about the healthcare system. It saw the big divide as being between the insured and the uninsured. And I think that's a very simplistic and probably inaccurate evaluation of what the key problems are in healthcare. Ever greater price inflation, care that is more expensive over care that is less expensive, care that is wasteful and therefore harmful over that that is needed. The idea of adding 16 million more people to Medicaid and the difficulty with the Affordable Care Act, like so much of the political discussion of healthcare, is it's all about insurance, as if insurance is healthcare and as if healthcare is health. What we have in this country is a system that is already hazardous to your health and to your pocketbook.
What about solutions? Do we realistically think that we can improve the system that we have now?
Well, I think we see green shoots all the time in the system. And the question is not just how are we going to pay for it, but how are we going to make sure that innovation, service, quality, and safety in healthcare are truly accountable? I think we've gone through 50 years of relying on intermediaries to drive those things, and I think they failed. And so as a business person, I look at it and say, there is no other business like that. And we give it a pass because we say healthcare is so complicated, that's why it's like that. I spend a lot of time in hospitals. One thing has nothing to do with another. The simplest thing, you go to a dry cleaner, your bill's computerized. They've been using electronic records and dry cleaners for 10 years, right? It's not because they only hire guys with computer science to be at the counter a dry cleaner. It's that it's expensive to lose a shirt. Almost no technology in hospitals is interoperable. They don't buy interoperable technology, even information technology, which is why you fill out the same form, you know, 200 feet from where you filled it out last time. That stuff is all about lack of accountability. The social returns to investing in technology, for information technology and healthcare, are gigantic. But since nobody can capture those returns in a business, they're just not made. I think we need a greater role for the patient as consumer. We're going to have to take more responsibility. It probably means taking some of the $2.7 trillion that we're flowing through an insurance system and flowing it back through us as individuals, so that we are the customers the system needs to chase. We are the customers the system needs to satisfy.
David Goldhill. He's the author of the new book, Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. David, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jackie.
The poem by Emily Dickinson, I died for beauty but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in an adjoining room, inspires the title of a new biography of Dorothy Rinch, a pathbreaking mathematician who faced in her life the kind of tumult that scientific inquiry sometimes inspires. Few people outside the sciences have heard of Dorothy Rinch. In 1929, she became the first woman ever to receive a doctorate of science from Oxford University. That only begins her largely unknown story. Smith College professor Marjorie Seneschal's new book is called I Died for Beauty, Dorothy Rinch and the Culture of Science. Seneschal begins by telling us about their relationship.
She was old enough to be my grandmother. But I met her because I had trained as a mathematician, but I became very interested in crystals. And I didn't know anybody who knew anything about that. And by a long route, I found her because she had gone the same path. And she had taught at Smith for many years. Now she was retired and she still had her office. She worked every day, all day. And someone told me I should go see her. And so I did. I knocked on her door and that changed my life.
You know, I just have to say the two of you bond over the most wonderful book, which I'm so pleased to know about, called The Ornament of Grammar by Owen Jones. This is actually going to lead you to studying crystallography. Tell us about how the two of you were fascinated by that book.
This book is a book that was published in 1865. It's so heavy that you can hardly lift it up. It's 100 beautiful plates of ornaments. Like wallpaper and rugs and tiles on walls and ceilings from all over the world in all different eras. And this had been compiled in the 1860s by Owen Jones. And the only way to really reach the true sense of ornament was to go to the rest of the world and see how they did things there.
And she's using it to draw her models, and that's also what's drawing you in.
These particular beautiful ornaments are analogous to the way that atoms are arranged in crystals. And that's why we were fascinated.
So Dorothy Wrench, to step back a bit, she's born in 1894 in South America, but she grows up in a nearly rural suburb of London. She goes to a wonderful school for girls, a special school, and she becomes one of Girton College's first pupils when Girton is still a brand new school. It'll later become part of Cambridge University. What is she like, this young woman? Why is she remarkable?
Well, her determination was certainly one thing. I mean, she was determined to be a mathematician. She worked her head off. She was known, everyone considered her the biggest workaholic they ever had known. But at the same time, she was very vivacious and gregarious. She had a knack for making friends. Her best friend, Dora Black, said that she was, in fact, the most driven and person who had the clearest sense of what she wanted to do of anybody.
She develops a theory of the way proteins are formed, the architecture of proteins. Could you tell us about that?
They had just discovered, they being the protein chemists, the chemists in general, had just discovered that proteins were molecules. And this is so taken for granted today that it's hard to imagine a time when they didn't understand that. When it became clear that they were molecules, meaning that there was a definite structure, that the atoms were in particular places, their role in our lives, keeping us alive, had to do with where those places were. Then the question is, well, where are those places? And the one theory that had been proposed before was that it makes a long chain. That's still what people believe. But she said no, that that's not the way it is. So she proposed instead that the chains form rings, and the rings join together. And she came up with a model that looked like lace. It was absolutely beautiful. And then she would have the lace fold up, so as if you're making an origami cage.
You have many pictures of that in the book, and you describe her as going to the grocery store to buy tapioca balls and then dyeing them and sticking them together. And she told you what store you could go to in Cambridge to do this.
It was very funny because you dye them with food dye. I still have all that stuff. And then use Elmer's glue to stick them together with use a toothpick for the applicator. It was very funny, but they work. I mean, you can make beautiful models that way.
All this beauty, there's so many ways that you play on that concept of beauty is truth or beauty is its science. The subtitle of this book is The Culture of Science. And in the 30s and 40s, this is such a male-dominated culture within our male-dominated culture.
Yes.
I loved your sentence. You take her to Cold Spring Harbor, a very important scientific conference in 1940, and you say, what is she doing here? What is she doing here? What is she doing here?
And then later I have, what is she doing here? And every single way that you could read it is what people were saying about her.
And then not long thereafter, Science Being a World Then is Now, supported by grants, torn by rivalries, she's attacked by another scientist, Linus Pauling. Now, we know now that Linus Pauling will go on to win two Nobel Prizes, but he is utterly vicious to her.
And he thought it was perfectly fine to be that way, because here she was a mathematician, she didn't know what she was doing. It's true she didn't know very much chemistry, and he could always nail her on the details. But she had a beautiful vision that had excited many, many people, many, many scientists, many of them Nobel Prize winners, thinking that there must be something to what she's saying because it explained things so well, so many of the properties that they had wanted to have explanations for. And Linus Pauling thought she's wrong because she doesn't have the chemistry right. She was assuming there was a bond that he didn't think existed, although it did. And so he just decided to do her in. It was literally that. And to march into this fray and get rid of her by laughing her out of the profession.
What impact does it have on her career?
It destroyed it. It just destroyed it. She pulled herself together and began working on X-ray diffraction theory.
She becomes an academic, and I think you could say it's certainly not a bad thing to wind up teaching at Smith College, but that was not the life that she'd envisioned.
It's just that she was so marginalized, and she never gave up. She kept on working to the very end.
Did Dorothy Wrench think she was a failure at the end?
There's some very touching notes that she left. She said, it's really okay not to be proteins Newton. There are other things. You can make other contributions. And she was writing these notes to herself. So I think she had hoped to be somehow the one who really, really brought Newton's kind of light to the whole subject of biology, and she didn't. And then she was trying to console herself that she'd done some things. But I wanted to write about her because she'd always stayed with me after she died. I thought about her a lot.
What does the theme I Died for Beauty suggest to you?
It suggests to me The struggle that she had with Linus Pauling, as you read at the beginning the first stanza of the poem, and let me read the second one, which is the one that I think that touched me the most and made me realize this had to be the title. I was scarce adjusted the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in the adjoining room. And then the next stanza, he questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth, the two are one. We brethren are, he said. And this is what I think the whole story is about on the intellectual level, is the struggle to look for simple answers to complex questions, and we do this all the time. We try to wade through the data, wade through the complexity, and see what's really going on here. But sometimes we don't find that. This is an ongoing sort of dialogue between truth and beauty that I think is continuing in science everywhere else today.
Marjorie Seneschal, her new book is called I Died for Beauty, Dorothy Rinch and the Cultures of Science. Thank you, Marjorie.
Well, thank you so much, Jackie.
And it's time now for a musician with an amazing story of transformation, from a childhood spent trapped in a cult to becoming the toast of the indie rock world. As a boy, Christopher Owens was raised by a single mother, a follower of the nomadic religious cult called Children of God. They skipped across continents. No telephones, no TV, no outside books, just their tight-knit community of hippie expatriates. Restrictive, yet the Children of God taught Owens and the other kids in the cult to sing and play guitar on the street for spare change. That's even partially how they supported themselves. It's also how Christopher Owens found a way out. He turned his busking into a one-way ticket back to the States. And before he knew it, he was playing before packed houses with his band called Girls. I'm gonna get you home. Christopher Owens joined me from member station KQED in San Francisco, and I asked him about growing up in this globe-trotting, hermetically sealed community.
Sometimes I'd be in a house with 500 other people, sometimes just a couple other families. But always it was the same group and the same beliefs, so I kind of grew up being very indoctrinated by these beliefs that were very important to the people in my mother's generation that joined this group. And it wasn't necessarily the case for the second generation. The kids kind of had a hard time just accepting blindly that we were supposed to live in the same way that they had chose to live in. And we really wanted to experience the world for ourselves and make our own decisions. And you know, by the time they had their first crop of teenagers, they really ran into a lot of problems because we all wanted to watch television, listen to the radio, and just do regular things.
You wanted to be part of a wider world. So
yeah.
What did you do? I know you left when you were in your mid-teens, pretty early.
Yeah, I was 16. I wanted to leave probably by the time I was 14, really badly. But my oldest sister left first, and that helped me to be able to leave. And that's when I moved to the United States for the first time.
Where had you been living?
I moved from Slovenia, but I was in Asia, all over Asia, until 1990 when I was 10, and then spent the next 6 years all over Europe.
But when did music kind of thread it all through and thread it together for you?
Well, music was always a big part of my life. I mean, that was part of my education. We weren't really schooled in a regular way, but we all learned to sing. And so I had a lot of musical experience in my life, but I didn't view it as some kind of career or as trying to be a rock star. It was more of a religious background for me.
Mm-hmm.
But many years later, by the time I moved here to San Francisco, I met some young guys who were playing rock and roll music, and I became friends with them. I wanted to be around them. I really liked their band. They let me kind of travel with them a little bit, and that's really what got music back in my life. That really brought out the background that I had. You know, but by 27, it was back in full force for me, and that's when I started to write songs.
Oh, I wish I had a boyfriend. I wish I had a loving man in my life. I wish I had a father. Maybe then I would have turned out right. But now I'm just crazy.
Christopher Owens then formed his own band called Girls. You're listening to some of their music now. And once their first album came out in 2009, their momentum was hard to stop. Rapturous reviews and world tours followed.
Owens left Girls not long ago, and he's using his first solo album as a way to look back at that experience.
It's really just a day-by-day account of the first tour that I went on with Girls.
So here we go, with my face in my hands where they should be. Airplane, take us all away to New York City.
The album is named after a woman he fell in love with in France at the end of that tour, and she had a name befitting an album title, Lysandra.
She was a girl that I met working at the festival that we played at in the south of France in Yer.
Great name.
Yes, very classic name. The name has a lot of appeal, and for me anyway. It's kind of a romantic, special name.
And I love the way that you commemorate your story with this young woman, Lysandra, who seems, you know, both like a real person and with that fantastic classical name, some kind of iconic young woman and almost sort of Hellenic. Just tell us just a little bit about, you know, even if the romance is long over and you've remembered this way, what it was like.
Well, I mean, really, she was very normal. It wasn't that she was super dynamic. I mean, the name is great, but realistically, she was a teenage girl from this beach town, you know, and just very normal. And I think that's why I was able to have a very meaningful experience with her.
Because she wasn't overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's very exciting to be an American guy in a band from California and travel that far to the Riviera and meet a young girl and have a romantic experience. That's very nice.
Just when I thought it was over, I said, come sit on my lap.
This is the song Everywhere You Knew. Great story about this courtship in the music festival where you met.
You said, let's get up and go somewhere new.
Christopher, presumably you've had a few romances through the years. Why did this one stick with you?
To be honest, it's really more about the time period that I wanted to talk about. And then the fact that at the end of the whole thing there's a beautiful romantic story. It's just the best way that I could think of presenting the album. But it's a record about the way I was feeling in a time that was very new.
And the last song on the record is called Part of Me, and it's where you say goodbye to this Lysandra. Yeah. And, you know, one hears it as a wistful ending, and perhaps you are saying goodbye to that first debut into the world that you had.
It's not meant to be at all sad or heavy, and you know, it's not like a breakup song. It's more of a song about being okay with the fact that people move on, that you don't always stay with every single person you meet and like. And sometimes you have a nice experience with somebody, but then that's it.
Has this woman heard the album or heard even other?
Yeah, we've always stayed friends. I went back to France maybe a dozen times, and she was always around, and she always stayed a friend.
Pretty great. I wish, you know, I'd love that kind of homage.
Yeah.
That's Christopher Owens. He's formerly of the band Girls, and his first solo album is called Lysandra. It comes out Tuesday, and you can sample a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Christopher Owens, thank you very much for your time, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
For the week ending January 13, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Lauren Silverman, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squires, Phil Harrell, Rebecca Hersher, and Chris Connolly.
Shula Newman edited the show. Our technical directors are Daniel Shukin and Rob Berman. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.